Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome to LSE. So my name is Jonathan Hopkin. I'm a convener of the Master's Program in Comparative Politics in the Government Department. And it's my great pleasure and honor this evening to chair this talk by my colleague Brian Klass, who's here to my right. So this is also an event marking the launch of Brian's new book, The Despot's Accomplice, How the West is Aiding and Abetting the Decline of Democracy. So this is, you know, a gripping title. And if you were wondering whether this was worth listening to, that should dispel any doubts. This sounds, it's a fascinating subject. Just let me just say a couple of words about Brian. So he's a BA from Carleton College in the US, but did his PhD at Oxford University. He works on quite a wide range of issues to do with, in a way, I guess, the dysfunctions of political systems and the difficulties of establishing democracy. So democracy, democratic transitions, election rigging, which is something that as an American he may have a word or two to say about. That there are suggestions that this election, the election in the US, is rigged, of course, not me that's making them, and the economic risks and consequences of these difficulties. So Brian's also written a range of articles and book chapters, as well as this new book, and that's all I have to say. I'll hand over the floor to Brian. He'll speak for about 40 minutes or so, and then we'll have a round of Q&A. And so I look forward to hearing Brian's talk and hearing what you, the audience, have to say about it and the questions you have for him. So go ahead.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Jonathan, for that lovely introduction, and thank you all for taking time out of your evenings to come here. 4 years ago, I was in Madagascar meeting with the head of a political party, one of the major political parties on the island. And I was being told why his party was superior to all the other ones. So he sort of said to me, unlike the other parties, we are a party of values. I said, okay, so which values are those? And he got this deer-in-the-headlights look in his face and turned to his aide and said, I forgot the values in the car. Could somebody get the values for the American, please? Now, this was one of these moments where it was very clear very quickly that something was wrong with how democracy was functioning there. And this is just one subset of what I call the global crisis of democracy. Now, we are in a moment where democracy is not working for a lot of people. And I started this book because the expert consensus is that since 2006, democracy has declined around the world every year. So we've had a decade of democratic retreat. A minority of the world's population lives in genuine democracies. And if we don't do anything about that right now, we may have hit what I call peak democracy, where 2006 was the high watermark of democracy around the world. Now, why is this happening? There's a lot of reasons. But one of them is that people have also started to lose faith in the idea of democracy. Now, in some ways, you can't really blame them. In the United States, you have a system of government that has elevated someone to nearly the most powerful position on the planet. And when he was asked about his main foreign policy advisor, he said that I'm speaking with myself, number one, because I have a very good brain and I've said a lot of things. And if that doesn't make you question the system of democracy, I don't know what will. So what I did for my research over the last 5 years was I went around to a variety of different countries where democracy is not working. And I conducted 250 interviews with former heads of state, diplomats, politicians, ministers, former rebels, coup plotters, and a variety of other people, and tried to get to the bottom of what's going wrong with democracy around the world and how can we fix it. So the main thesis of my book is that the West is complicit in this decline of democracy, sometimes deliberately and sometimes inadvertently. And the book also argues how we can turn this around and spark a global resurgence of democracy. So I'm going to talk about six different points tonight. The first is I argue that the West has given up on democracy and has made the mistake of believing that the dictatorial devil we know is superior to the democratic devil we don't, and there's a risk aversion aspect of this. The second is that in places where democracy is promoted, the bar is set so low that countries have no real incentive to democratize fully, and they end up being what I call counterfeit democracies, places where governments pretend to be of the people, by the people, and for the people, rather than actually being that. The third point I'm going to make is that the West has a very difficult problem insofar as it only has sticks but no carrots in terms of enticing countries to democratize, so they need to find a new carrot. The fourth point I'm going to make is that despots have no reason to democratize because they're worried about the consequences of what happens to them if they lose power, and therefore we need to come up with something I call a golden handcuffs exit strategy to lure them away from power to give democracy a fighting chance. The fifth point is that the West needs to insist that, paradoxically and counterintuitively, that to save democracy during transitions, they have to incorporate elements of the old regime and the dictatorship that fell in order to make democracy work. And the final point I want to make, which goes back to our friend Mr. Trump here, is that democracy, in order to spread it abroad, we need to fix it at home. So those are the points I'm going to make tonight, and I'm going to go through them in a second. But before we get there, I want to ask a question that we don't always ask when we talk about democracy. Why is it good? Why do we actually need democracy? Now, there's actually some real benefits to authoritarian rule, and that's something that's totally taboo to say in some circles, but it's true. In 2003, China had the SARS epidemic and was facing a major health catastrophe, and they built a 1,000-bed hospital specifically for SARS in 8 days. They broke ground on a Tuesday, and the patients moved in on the following Wednesday. Now, if you try to do that in the UK under budget and on time, it would take 8 years, not 8 days. And so there is actually some upside to authoritarian rule, but it comes at a major cost. One authoritarian state, Turkmenistan, for example, used to be ruled by a dictator named Saparmurat Niyazov. Now, what you don't have in authoritarian rule is a marketplace of ideas that blocks bad ideas. Sometimes this is harmless. So one of the things he did was he banned lip syncing because it was a pet peeve. He also banned smoking because he was trying to quit and didn't want to be reminded of cigarettes. And perhaps most bizarrely, he changed the name for bread to Gurban Sultan, which was his mom's name, the giver of life, and made sure that all of his subjects referred to bread as Gurban Sultan. Now, those things are bizarre, but not necessarily damaging. What became damaging was when he decided to basically try to give everyone the benefit of this beautiful, opulent city that he'd built in Ashgabat. And so he said, when people get sick, they'll get better if they come here. So he closed all rural hospitals to force people to come to the capital, right? Countless thousands of people died. And even more people died when he decided to claw back 2 years of pension payments that had already been made to the elderly, simply so he could fund the Neutrality Arch, a $12 million statue of himself that rotates to face the sun. Now, this is something you can imagine more than ever happening in the Western countries. But the reality is that if that money was wasted and these bad ideas happened, there's recourse against them, right? And that they're usually blocked. I am personally optimistic that this will not come to pass, but if it were to, there are mechanisms built into democracy that authoritarianism does not have to block bad ideas or mitigate their consequences. Now, I want to move on to the first point I'm going to make, the idea that the democracy has been something that the West has given up on and has mistakenly decided that the dictatorial devil we know is superior to the democratic devil we don't. So I traveled to Minsk in Belarus last December to do some research, and Belarus is known as the last dictatorship in Europe. It's led by a man named Alexander Lukashenko. And when I first arrived, I met with one of the major presidential candidates from 2010, a guy named Mikhail Statkevich. Now, I went into this cafe. It's about the size of the average Costa or Starbucks in the UK, but it's totally empty. And we take a booth in the corner. And I sit down, and about a minute later, this young woman comes in, and she makes a beeline for the booth right next to ours. And she takes out her phone like this, and she pretends to be reading, but she's actually completely recording us, right? She was with the KGB. And he leans into me and says, I picked one of the cafes without the microphones embedded in the tables, so they had to do it the old-fashioned way. And this was obviously troubling. My Skype account was hacked and various things. I was trailed by these agents the entire time I was there. But the thing that was really troubling was what Statkevich told me, and that was that when he was an opposition politician, just for the simple crime of challenging the regime, he was tossed in a jail cell. And the regime asked him to sign a confession that he was an enemy of the state. He refused. So they sent him to solitary confinement and said, if you don't sign, we're going to keep you in here for years. He refused, so they did. And when that didn't break him, they put a person with psychotic episodes who was deeply mentally unstable into the same cell as him, trying to break him then, and he still refused. Another person I interviewed, Vladimir Nikolaev, who was also a presidential candidate, committed the crime of holding an opposition protest, and he was beaten nearly to death by iron rods from thugs from the regime in the streets, sent to a hospital where he nearly died, and as soon as it was clear he was going to make it, they abducted him from the hospital and threw him in a jail cell. So this is a bad place for opposition politicians. It is not a place you want to challenge the regime. And the question is, how does someone like this then stay in power, right? This, by the way, is the dictator of Belarus, Lukashenko, and people are well aware that he is constantly watching them. This is some bathroom graffiti. It's a nice resemblance. So Lukashenko is a guy who rigs elections. And it was fascinating hearing about how he does this. I talked to somebody who used to be in the regime, and you know, I'm not going to use his name for his own safety, but he said, what happens is you actually get a number. So in this case, he got the number 78%. That's what they wanted to win by, so that it was plausibly low for the West to believe it, but high enough that it looked like he was in charge. But then he said, we don't want to get in trouble. So we would tell our subordinates 81. And then they would tell their subordinates 83. And then the local people would get the number 85, and then everyone would deliver, and he would win by 85, which is why Lukashenko is one of the only people ever to have publicly admitted that he rigged an election downward, because he actually wanted to make it more plausible to the West. Now, the thing is, the West is not oblivious to this. I talked to several Western ambassadors, and there were harsh sanctions put on Belarus in 2004. But when I talked to these ambassadors, they said two things. One, we're worried about Russia. And two, Belarus is not Ukraine, and it cannot be Ukraine. And what they meant by that was that the democratic transition that had created all this instability in Ukraine had made them lose their appetite for democracy promotion. And they basically were ceding the fact that Lukashenko was going to be in power for years, if not decades, and that Belarus was going to have to bite the bullet with stability, because they believed that this was important for the region's stability. Now, sure enough, after the sanctions were lifted by the West in this spring, it came out yesterday that political executions have continued, or that at least they are planning to continue them. So this approach has basically failed. There's been no real reform, but still he's getting a free pass from the West. Now, this is not a new argument if you think about Western relationships with countries like Saudi Arabia, right? I mean, this is a brutal regime, and it's one of the West's closest allies on the global stage. And a map came to mind when I was thinking about this, where I looked at, it was a political risk map from 2010. And when you look at the Middle East in 2010, the green countries, the countries that are at no risk of collapse, were Tunisia, Egypt, and Syria, right? And you think about that, and that's what they were thinking at the time, was that these are the safe places, right? And that's the thing, that's the allure of authoritarian stability. It seems great until the mirage disappears and the regime collapses in catastrophic fashion. And then all of a sudden, you're left to clean up the mess. And the crucial question is, when that happens, which side do you want to be on? And I think in the long-term interest of the United States and Western governments in general, including Britain, is being on the right side of history and promoting democracy consistently. Now, the UK doesn't have the perfect track record with this, nor does the US. So since 2010, the UK has sold weapons to 39 of the 51 countries that Freedom House classifies as not free, its lowest rating possible. And I think that this is a really big problem. And I would argue that this myth that the dictatorial devil we know is better than the democratic devil we don't is not the right approach, and that we need to reinvigorate rather than run away from promoting democracy. The second point I want to make is about Madagascar, a country with the values in the car. So I call this the curse of low expectations, and this is particularly apt for countries that don't factor into the calculations of geopolitics very much. Madagascar, by the way, is sort of the poster boy for countries that do not factor into the calculations of geopolitics in the West, so much so that I would imagine there's only a handful of people who have ever heard of the capital, Antananarivo. And also, when I called my bank to tell them not to block my card on the first of my research visits to the island, the woman said, "Are you sure that's a country?" And I said, "Yes, it's the size of France, and it has 25 million people." And she said, "Oh, is it named after the cartoon?" I insisted it was actually the opposite, but you know, you win some, you lose some. So now Madagascar has fascinating politics. In 2009, this is one of the coups I studied for my PhD. In 2009, this incumbent president, who was accurately described as a yogurt kingpin, who was one of the richest people on the island because of his dairy empire, was unseated by a 34-year-old radio disc jockey. And this is a fascinating place. The radio DJ ruled for 5 years. And yet there's this disconnect, because this is considered a democracy. Now, I met with one person in Madagascar who really stood out, and this was General Desiré Philippe Ramakavelo. I've had breakfast with him each of the 6 times that I've conducted research in Madagascar, and he is arguably responsible for why multi-party elections exist there. I went to his house, this villa, and he explained to me, and this is totally true, that in 1992, the opposition politician and the incumbent president were disagreeing about whether to introduce elections. He kidnapped both of them, put them in a hotel called the Hotel Panorama at the base of his villa, and told them they could come out when they had signed an accord. And in Madagascar history, this is known as the Panorama Convention. Well, that's the backstory for it. But I also asked him about why democracy was suffering so much today in Madagascar. And he said, quite earnestly, turned to me and said, the only way I could possibly answer that question is with one of my poems. So he sat me down on his couch, and he opened up this book of poems that he wrote, because he's an amateur poet on the side. And he read one called Le Langouste, which is French for the rock lobster. And what he was arguing is, he says, all that matters to the West is the shell and the meat. And he says, as long as the shell is democratic and you can get to the meat, which by which he means the resources and the oil that people believe is in Madagascar, etc., the shell is all we care about, right? And this is something that I think actually is very, very true for Madagascar. I met with one former head of state who told me, oblivious to the fact that I was a researcher who might talk about this, that the prices of votes in every district. He said, oh, this district it's this much, this district that much. I talked to some opposition politicians who said this is a place where opposition politicians manage to fall down the stairs but lose their fingernails on the way down. And when I was there in May, it was somewhere where they pulled over a sitting government minister, and he had 1,000 kilograms of drugs in his personal vehicle. So this is not a shining star of democracy. Now juxtapose that with what happened when I was an election observer in 2013 for Madagascar's elections. This is a scene that I took during that process, and that's the former president of Mauritius, who was on the observation team. Basically, the polls had just closed. They had counted about 3,000 votes, and all of the Western observation teams declared the election free and fair. And it was certainly not free and fair. But there's only 2 possible modes that an election can be judged, not free and fair or free and fair. And you only reserve the not free and fair for the really bad cases, right? And it's this curse of low expectations where they think, what do you expect? This is a place where democracy is going to be low quality, so marginal gains are enough for us to give it the thumbs up. I talked to one European Union observer who, again, didn't want to be named for obvious reasons, who told me that the European Union had allocated aid money already to Madagascar, and therefore that if they declared it not free and fair, the money would have to sit in an account doing absolutely nothing, and they had decided that unless there was mass violence, the thumbs up was coming. This was before the election, right? So the problem with this is that when you have a system that doesn't reward real gains but rewards a low bar, people gravitate towards the low bar. Now, this is the one boring chart in my presentation, but I did research looking at this, actually trying to figure out the systematic effect here. What you're seeing is effectively different types of election rigging at the rates at which they're condemned by Western observers, depending on whether they're in Africa or not in Africa. And in every type of election observation, the same types of rigging are condemned less frequently in Africa than elsewhere. Now, what does that tell you if you're an African elite, right? You're going to gravitate towards the low bar because there's no consequences to doing anything else. And I call this electoral grade inflation. The same way that sort of you have this in academia, you have it also in election observation. Now, this leads me to my next point, which is that you need to have a way. So part of the reason why the curse of low expectations exists is because you don't want to wield the stick all the time, and a lot of countries are not doing the best democratic things, right? But there's no carrot. And so my argument is that we need to come up with a new carrot. So last November, I went to Riga in Latvia, and it's this is a lovely building called the Corner House. It looks lovely from the outside. Inside, it is quite different. This was the KGB headquarters during the Soviet period, and it's as gruesome as you would think it would be. They paint the floors of the cells red so that it doesn't stain them when there's blood. They have hooks in the courtyard to sort of hoist people up if they won't talk. And they even would put cars outside idling with their motors so that when they use summary executions with gunshots, the neighbors wouldn't hear. I mean, it's a grisly place. But the thing that is really shocking about the Corner House is not as much what's inside it now, but what's outside it. Because Riga is actually an unbelievably beautiful city. It was the 2014 culture capital of Europe, and it's a full-fledged democracy. And it's not just that it became democratic in a span of a couple years. It's also that it actually became a hugely successful economy in comparative terms. So when you start off in 1992 with Latvia, the average person was making about $5 a day, about $1,800 a year. Now, today, you fast forward to that, and it's $15,000 a year and about $42 a day. And the thing that's amazing about this was that the transformation happened extremely quickly, and it was very simple, the reason why it happened. The European Union made a deal, basically, with Eastern and Central Europe after the Soviet Union fell, and said, if you democratize and you fit our criteria of various political reforms, you'll become a member of the greatest trade bloc on the planet. And rapidly, these gains accrued to the countries that did. You see Belarus not doing so well because it didn't reform and didn't become part of this bloc. Now, this was a really good thing for countries like Latvia, but it did absolutely nothing for a country like Liberia or Laos, right? Because you had to have a shared land border with the European Union. Now, today, we have a very controversial trade deal called the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I don't want to talk about the details of it, but I will say that what it tells you is that these countries are really far apart, right? Some of them are 10,000 miles from the other side. And so that means that we don't need to have contiguous land borders for trade deals to be possible. And so one potential carrot that you could imagine would be something like a democratic trade zone, right? Where full-fledged democracies are full members, and countries that are aspiring democracies and are making real demonstrated improvements get preferential access. Now, it's not a perfect idea. You'd have to iron out a lot of problems. You'd have to have an independent body that deals with what constitutes democracy and what doesn't. And you probably wouldn't want to have any political entanglements like a currency or major losses of sovereignty, just a trade zone. But it's something we should think about because it's a very big carrot. If you actually adapted it right now, you'd have between 6 and 7 out of every $10 in the global economy in this zone. And that would really be a massive enticement for a lot of countries around the world. The next thing I wanted to talk about is my proposal I call golden handcuffs. So this is the idea that we need to find an exit strategy for despots and dictators who have overstayed their welcome. In 2010, Laurent Gbagbo, who is the president of Cote d'Ivoire in West Africa, one of the countries that I work in, he was called by President Obama, and the reason for this was because Gbagbo had just lost the election. But he said, I didn't lose, and I'm going to fight to the death, and I'll activate my troops, and we'll have a civil war if we need to. So Obama called him and said, look, you lost fair and square. Why don't you come to Boston and become a professor? Because you're an African history professor before you were president. We'll hook you up with a sweet deal, and you can leave, right? And Gbagbo said no, rejected it, a civil war happened, he was ousted, he's now in The Hague, Gbagbo is, for war crimes during the civil war, and this horribly ghastly experience was allowed to proceed, even though Obama tried to stop it. Now, a more successful instance where this was actually proposed, adopted, and worked, at least for a short time, was with Raoul Cedras in Haiti, who was a terrible guy. He came to power in the early 90s in a coup d'etat, he's a military leader, and he killed, in the wake of his coup, between 1,000 and 3,000 people. This is not a good leader. But what basically happened was the U.S. started to worry about the copycat effect, that some other countries would start to see Haiti as a model and would replicate it. So there was an operation launched by the Clinton administration called Operation Uphold Democracy. What it basically meant was we're going to send some warships off the coast of Haiti, and we're going to issue an ultimatum that you need to step down or we'll invade. Now, the Haitian government rattled its sabers right back at the American government with slightly more strange ones, because in Haiti, the culture of voodoo still has a lot of currency, and so they made the threat to the Americans that if you invade us, we will unleash a horde of 60,000 invisible zombies, they will be armed with HIV-infected syringes, and they have a special plant that if you rub it on an American GI, it will cause all of their skin to fall off. And to top this off, they sent Hungans, which are these voodoo priests, to the American embassy where they drew symbols outside on the street. Now, on the same day, September 12, 1994, that the symbols were drawn, a truck driver in Maryland decided that he was going to take his the private plane that he occasionally flew on the weekends and fly it into the White House. And he aimed for the Clinton bedroom, and he did not actually succeed in hitting the White House. He crashed on the lawn, and Clinton was not there. But the Hungans and Cedras believed this was an absolutely clear sign that they needed to entrench because their symbols had worked and that the American government was set up for disaster. So you had this massive showdown brewing, right? And so the West, rather than up the ante even more and invade, decided to offer Cedrus a golden parachute. And the deal that they struck over a long period of diplomatic negotiations was a very strange one, but a very cheap one. For less than $1 million, and also bizarrely, one of the things Cedrus insisted on was that the United States government needed to pay the lease of his mom's villa in Peggyville in Haiti, so that fundamentally the American taxpayer was on the hook to pay $4,000 a month in rent for this former dictator's mom. But for this price of about $1 million and safe passage to a place where he would not get killed, Cedrus stepped down. And democracy was given a fighting chance, and it was briefly heading in that direction in Haiti. Now, it didn't work out in Haiti, and Haiti is one of these countries where you look at the news and you're like, could anything else go wrong in this country? But it is somewhere where, you know, for a bargain price, they were able to get rid of somebody who was not going to cede power, who was never going to be democratic, and who was doing terrible things to the economy and to the people. Now, the question is, you know, this is something where I'm advocating something that's very morally difficult. And I have to hold my nose when I say that I think this is the right plan. And I don't think that he should have gotten a golden parachute. I think he should have gotten golden handcuffs, where he had to forfeit all the money that he earned or stole from the government, ended up in a safe villa somewhere, but was under house arrest for a set period of time, right? And you can calibrate this how you want to. You can deal with the proposal in different ways. And war criminals, I think, need to go to the ICC, the International Criminal Court, no matter what, because they're the worst of the worst, and we cannot possibly allow them to get away with those crimes and incentivize them. But I think you need to think outside the box, because the current approach is not really working. This is something where we have currently, I think the number of, so there's 27 leaders in power currently who have been in power for more than 15 years. There are 13 leaders currently who have been in power for more than 25 years. And the crown prince of overstaying his welcome is the leader of Cameroon, Paul Biya, who took power during the Vietnam War when Queen was atop the charts and when our Queen, Queen Elizabeth II, was 53 years old, right? And he has people who are aspiring to beat that record, like the president of Gambia, Yahya Jammeh, who has said, if I have to rule this country for 1 billion years, I will. Now, he's got a long way to go from his current tally of 22, but everyone loves a dreamer. So it's, you know, the thing about this, though, is that it's actually totally rational what they're doing. I know that sounds very strange. But I found that in Africa since 1960, when independence was initiated, 43% of leaders that left power were either jailed, exiled, or killed. So that means you got about a 50-50 chance of either getting killed, never being able to go home, or rotting away in a prison cell. And these are not nice prison cells, right? And I think that a lot of people, like Mitt Romney, for example, might think about the election in 2012 a little differently if he thought he was going to be dragged through the streets of Salt Lake City if he lost. And all of a sudden, with this in mind, repression and election rigging make a lot of sense. And that's why I think we need to think outside the box and try to come up with some creative solutions that incentivize leaders to voluntarily leave power rather than overstaying their welcome. The fifth point I want to make is something I call the unthinkable olive branch. Now, the West obviously had a poor record in Iraq. I think that would be an understatement, but One of the first things they did in 2003 after the United States toppled the regime was a process of debathification. They had two orders that happened right after the invasion. Order one purged everyone who was in the Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein's party. And order two dismantled the Iraqi army and sent everyone with guns home with a weapon but without a paycheck. Now, if you want to come up with a recipe for a civil war, make sure all the powerful people with experience running the government have no vested interest in the country's success, and make sure all the people with weapons don't get paid. There's really not a better way to do this, I would say. And that's exactly what happened. We ended up with a terrible crisis in Iraq because of this. So the West was directly involved in this one, obviously. Now, Libya, unfortunately, did not learn this lesson. So when Gaddafi was toppled, they proposed, debated, and eventually passed a thing called the Political Isolation Law, which basically said anyone who is tainted by the stain of Muammar Gaddafi can no longer be involved in politics. Well, the problem with this is that Gaddafi was in power for 42 years. So you've got anyone who knows anything about running the country is all of a sudden barred with the stroke of a pen from being involved in political life. And we know what happened in Libya, right? I mean, after the toppling of Gaddafi with the Western invasion, or at least the Western airstrikes, the country fell apart. So I traveled to Tunis around this time to try to get to the bottom of how they were grappling with this problem. And there was something called the immunization of the revolution law that was proposed. And I met with, it was a similar type of purge of former people who were affiliated with the Ben Ali regime. And one of the most memorable interviews I've had in my entire life was with this man. His name is Saeed Ferjani. He grew up poor in Tunisia and became disaffected with politics very early because he was a devout Muslim. And at the time, Habib Bourguiba, the president of Tunisia, actually made such a secular statement that he literally went on TV during Ramadan and sipped orange juice without saying anything just to show that he could, right? And so this alienated people like Ferjani considerably. They didn't have a place in the society. And so he plotted a coup in 1987. Now, unfortunately for Ferjani, his coup plot coincided with Ben Ali's coup plot, who is Bourguiba's prime minister. And Ben Ali took power, but this plot was already in motion, and so Ferjani's plot was exposed. So very quickly, they were arrested. Ferjani was tortured in unbelievably atrocious ways. And he was in a coma for 5 days. After he left and was released, he was wheelchair-bound. And they broke his back completely, but as he told me, they didn't break his will. And what he did is he vowed to escape from Tunisia. And so he taught himself through the wincing pain to get up from the wheelchair and walk 50 meters at a time so that he would not arouse suspicion at the airport when he tried to get through customs. So with a borrowed passport and a limp, he walked through customs, escaped, made it to London, and spent the next 25 years in exile here. Now, Ferjani in 2011, when the regime fell, decided to come back to Tunis. And he said, I want to build a democracy. I want to make sure that this is not a place where this happens to other people. And so I went and I interviewed him at his house. And I expected, this guy is he's an intimidating-looking guy. He's actually one of the nicest people ever. He's got this booming laugh and really jovial. But he surprised me because as soon as I said, well, of course you're for this purge, these are the people that tortured you, he said, no. I am for keeping the body even as we cut off the head. And what he meant by that is that for Tunisian democracy to survive, we needed to keep intact some of the institutions of the old regime so we're not just building it from scratch. And he extended an olive branch by defeating this bill with his party that saved Tunisia, in my opinion. It's what saved democracy because all of a sudden people who were powerful in the old society and people who had weapons had a chance to buy into the new system rather than fight against it. And it was very prescient about how he dealt with it because the actual way of diminishing the people's role that he was trying to diminish was much more effective democratically than it would have been with a ban. What I mean by this is I interviewed a presidential candidate, Kamal Morjane. Morjane was one of Ben Ali's sort of right-hand guys. He was the Minister of Foreign Affairs for Tunisia. So he's sort of, you know, pretty high up in this old regime. But because the law didn't pass, Morjane was allowed to run in the elections in 2014. Now, he got 1.2% at the ballot box. And I can tell you, nothing cuts a politician who used to be in power down to size like getting 1.2% in a free and open democratic election. It was so much more effective than if they had just banned him outright. And so Ferjani had a very good sense of foresight, but the West has not necessarily learned from this. And so one of the arguments I make for transitions to survive, we need to insist that they are inclusive and incorporate elements of the old regime, even though that seems very counterintuitive. This jives, by the way, very well with the findings I had in my PhD, which showed that excluding opposition figures doubles the risk of violence in the form of coups and civil wars because it destabilizes the country and precisely the way, as I said, it doesn't give them buy-in. It gives them a reason to fight against the status quo or the new order, right? Now, Tunisians of the world need help, though. Tunisia is struggling. It's got economic problems. It has the threat of terrorism. And I think we need to do more to help them. And this might be somewhere where the carrots of economic incentives can be very, very helpful. But just because we have extended an unthinkable olive branch to the remnants of some truly unsavory people doesn't mean that their memories go away or doesn't mean that they're totally forgiven. I talked to Ferjani this May, or this April, I think it was, in London. And we met in a cafe, and I asked him again about this and how it's going in Tunisia now. And I was asking him how it feels to know that some of the people in the government are people who are complicit in torturing him. And it was heartbreaking because, you know, he's staked his career on building this democracy, and he still says, look, my knees hurt every day when I walk. If I turn over in the night when I'm sleeping, I wake up every time because my vertebrae are still completely busted up. And most of all, I feel guilty about the fact that the regime used my family and my friends to try to get to me by making them suffer. And I was, you know, furiously scribbling these notes, and this pause that I've unfortunately gotten used to because I've interviewed a lot of torture victims happened where I just look up, and he's buried his hands in his face in his hands, and is crying in this cafe in London. And I think, you know, this is the amazing thing about him, is that, and about Tunisia in general, is they put democracy above of the personal vengeance that they must have felt, right? But he said, I am not going to participate in a transition that does to me, or does to someone else what was done to me. And I think that's very admirable, and something we should learn from. But I also think that, to switch gears considerably, we need to lead by example in order to present a model of why democracy matters to the rest of the world, and we're not doing that super well right now. This is something where I think the West needs to be very introspective. In order to sell democracy abroad, you need to fix it at home. So we're in a situation now where you have Brexit, you have the Trump effect, and there could be a series of lectures about what's going on here, so I'm not going to talk about this at length. But I think there's a few things that I want to highlight about what's broken about Western democracy. The first is this explosion of media options, this menu of media. Now, Facebook categorizes people in the United States based on their perceived political beliefs with an algorithm. This is blue Facebook and red Facebook talking about abortion politics. And the stories that you read are totally different. Like, they couldn't be more different, right? And it entrenches polarization, which is deeply, deeply unsettling for democracies, right? Because democracy works with compromise and consensus the way that Tunisia has forged it. You also have a serious problem, which, again, could be many, many lectures, of inequality, where people don't believe the establishment system, as it functions now, can solve their problems. And I think one of the very few things that could be a positive from the whole Trump phenomenon in the United States is that the establishment politicians have a wake-up call, and they realize that they've left these people who have not been making it in the global economy behind, but that they need to actually articulate a different vision of change that is not about turning against your neighbor or turning against immigrants, but actually working to solve the problems that democracy has collaboratively. Now, there's other problems that are structural about democracy that are not new to 2016. So one of them is gerrymandering, where you draw district lines in a very convoluted way. This is the Illinois 4th Congressional District, believe it or not. It's lovingly termed Latin earmuffs because these two areas are very highly densely populated with Latino voters, and they're connected at times by, like, I think here it's literally a road that no one lives on. Nobody would ever draw this randomly, right? This is very, very deliberate. And the problem with gerrymandering, what they're trying to do is electoral gains that aren't natural, right? But the really big problem with it, I think, is that in a lot of districts now, in the sort of average congressional election, this one might be an outlier because it's so polarized and so divisive. But in the average congressional election, you've got 435 seats up for grabs, and you've probably got 25 to 35 seats that are actually competitive. Because a lot of these districts are drawn in ways that there's 80% of the people living in them are Republicans. Now, if you're a Republican congressman and you've got 80% of your backers in your district, why would you ever compromise, right? It only makes you look weak, it only upsets your base, and there's no reason for crossing the aisle, right? The same for the Democrats when they have 80% in their own districts. Now, I saw this up close myself. Before I was an academic, I worked in electoral politics in a campaign for governor. I co-managed a campaign for governor of Minnesota and worked for this guy who's still the governor named Mark Dayton. And it's amazing. So one of the things that I actually disagreed with him on was he was a staunch supporter of basically no restrictions on the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. But it was an important thing to be for in Minnesota because there's a big demographic of hunters, a variety of other reasons, right? And he believed in it. But he voted consistently the way the NRA would have usually, the National Rifle Association, usually would have wanted him to vote. And he was a Democrat, right? So this is somebody who's usually from the party that opposes this group working with them. It should have been like sort of their dream, right? He made one vote in 6 years as a United States senator where he voted to ban steel-tipped bullets that can pierce body armor, right? These are very useful if you want to shoot a cop and you want to pierce the body armor, and absolutely of no value if you're killing a deer. So he said, look, this is where we draw the line. Let's make sure that these are not for sale. And instantly, he was rated an F. He had previously been rated an A, and they began funding his opponent. And this is how reason dies in politics, right? That you don't have people who are actually willing to compromise and work with others getting knocked off by this absolutely corporatist and very money-driven system where you can really knock out sort of the middle ground. Now, I think about where this leaves us. we have to fix democracy at home in order to spread it abroad. We have to do a variety of different things with how democracy functions and how foreign policy functions in the rest of the world. But it's been a bad decade for democracy. There's no other way to say it. We've lost democratic gains that were explosive after the Cold War, and now it's been in decline every year. If we act quickly and wisely, I think we can reverse the trend. I think we can spark a global resurgence of democracy. But a lot of things need to change. And I think about all these experiences and where I sort of think is the outlook going forward, and it depends on where we are. When I think about Mikhail Statkevich in Belarus, I have a very poor outlook for his future. He's an opposition politician, a regime that's not going to change, and that the West has no appetite to change. When I think about General Rama Kabelo in Madagascar, it's one of the poorest countries on Earth, and nobody really has an interest in it anyway, and the interest they are showing is somewhat counterproductive. But I also think about those times in Riga, and I think about Said Firjani, and I think about, imagine if I was at the corner house in 1990 with these prisoners, you know, suffering these horrible, horribly brutal consequences, and telling them, look, in a few years, Riga is going to look like this. You're going to be using the same currency that's used on the Champs-Élysées, and you're going to live in a democracy. It was unthinkable at that time, right? Can you imagine that? Or Firjani in 2010 in London, and saying to him, in 5 years, your country's not only going to be a democracy, it's also going to win the Nobel Peace Prize for the way it approached democracy. And that's why I think there is hope. I think there is a way forward, and there is a better way to deal with this problem. But until then, we're going to continue acting as the despot's accomplice rather than the Democrats' accomplice. And in that period that where the reform needs to happen, it's going to be extremely challenging. There's going to be a lot of setbacks along the way, and there's going to be a lot of politicians who don't have the stomach for the risk that democratization presents. But I believe that even though those perils exist, we need to at least try. Thank you very much. That's my talk for today, and I'd be happy to answer some questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Brian. There's a lot of food for thought there. An incredibly impressive range of cases that he's done research on. We have we can go between 30 and 45 minutes of time for questions. We have roving mics, do we? Yep. So the way I'm going to do this, raise your hands. I'm very short-sighted. So be patient. I will try and get you roughly in the order in which you raise your hands. Bear in mind also there are two floors here of people. But also, I may get the order wrong, but the other thing is that I will use a principle of discrimination, which is that all else equal, preference will be given to those who are not white males who can remember the last time the pound was worth as little as it is now against the dollar. So if you're feeling left out, that may well be the reason. Okay. So, blonde lady at the back, gentleman at the back there, and there's a gentleman with a woolly hat.
Are we doing three at a time?
And that we'll do three at a time, okay. And that should allow more scope for people to ask.
Great.
So, when the mic reaches you, fire away.
I was wondering if you've ever come across what you think is an example of a benign authoritarian rule, and whether, for example, like the Singapore model, whether you think that could ever be sort of surpass democracy in terms of things that we could aspire to?
Right.
Okay. There's one more at the back there.
I'm personally interested in the last item in your shopping list. Mm-hmm. I went to a conference once in Warsaw by the OECD, and I met a very impressive lady with a military uniform from America who said, I'm the Undersecretary for Democracy. I said nothing, but she immediately followed that up by saying, I don't know what it means either, which I think is very significant. But my more particular question is, not what does she do for a living, because she doesn't know, but how do you think anybody in the West can talk to anybody else about democracy when we don't have one anyway?
Okay, thank you. Yep.
I'm waiting until he writes down what he
wants. Go ahead.
You've presented a multi-layered model. Why not, that I feel could be one-sided, why not take two parts, establish an authoritarian system, use military might, and then apply some of your principles? That seems to be a model that was used on Japan after World War II. Why not use violence in order to get peace?
Okay, thank you very much. Brian.
Sure. Okay, so let's start with the first one, the benign authoritarianism. There's two things I would say about this. One is that people make the Singapore argument very commonly, and I think there's good reason to, but I also think, you know, if you think of a simple thought experiment about, imagine that you're in the womb and you can choose where to be born, and you don't know which country it's going to be, but it's authoritarian or it's democratic, right? Everyone will pick a democracy because the odds are so much greater that you'll end up in Eritrea than Singapore. So these outliers are outliers. That's the first thing. The second thing I would say is that Singapore, no one has explained to me why Singapore couldn't be a democracy and still have its growth rates, right? I think that there's a lot of benefits to Singapore's model over time, but I think now there's no reason why it couldn't open up. So to me, it's that, you know, it's this Churchill, the Churchill argument, the one that says democracy is the worst form of government except for all the other types that have been tried. I believe that. And I've never heard anyone say a better model. And the reason for that is because you might have some benevolent dictatorships, but they're benevolent until they're not, and then you can't do anything about them, right? And that's the really big problem, because Singapore could turn, right? And then there's nothing to be done. Whereas if Trump gets elected, you'd much rather have him come to power in a democratic way and be able to block him and, you know, unseat him than the alternative. The idea we don't have a democracy, I mean, look, I'm the first one to admit that we have serious democratic problems. And I think there is a major amount of challenges in the West to overcome. That being said, the places I've been make me very, very happy to live here. And the people I've talked to, and I think that we do have a democracy. I think we have a flawed democracy. I think we have a place where there is a chance for meaningful participation that determines, to some extent, how your lives are run. And that might be a low bar for democracy. It might not be a full democracy, but it is meaningful participation, and there is meaningful input into how rules are made and laws are made. And so I think, you know, for me, it's you know, I think we can bash the West a little too much in that sense, because, I mean, you go to these places. In Madagascar, the average person makes $1.25 a day, right? And this is growth. And you see crippling poverty, and they have no recourse against it, none whatsoever. And they've had GDP, not growth, but declines for basically 95% of the time since independence. And there's nothing they can do about it. And I think, you know, for me, from my perspective, I think there's absolutely problems with American, British, all Western democracies, but that that we have a way to change them, right? And that's part of the stuff that I would talk about in terms of the fixing democracy at home, is that this isn't impossible to do. We may end up in these partisan echo chambers, and we may not pay attention to democracy or be activists as much, but we can, right? And I can tell you from working in a campaign, we pay attention to who votes. Like, we literally targeted all of our messaging to people who voted at least three of the last five elections when we had scarce resources, and that meant that we pandered to old people because they vote, right? And that meant we didn't care about student loans. We didn't care. I mean, honestly, this is what you do when you're actually figuring out how to allocate resources in a campaign. So if you want to change things, participate. And I would say don't take for granted the freedoms and the democratic input we have. They're real. The final point, why not use violence? Well, there's a few reasons. You're absolutely right. Japan is one of the rare examples where violence has ended up producing a democratic system. But there's a lot of features of Japan that don't exist in most countries. You have a uniform ethnicity, all sorts of other aspects. And the literature in political science shows that typically coming out of violence, the odds of democracies emerging is very, very low. Plus, I'm not really in favor of using... one of the chapters in my book is about what I call democracy wars, wars that are packaged as promotion of democracy, and I'm very opposed to them. The reason for that is because when Iraq and Afghanistan happened and they were pitched as ideas of democratization, it gave major amounts of cover to authoritarian regimes to kick out NGOs who were doing real work for political reform and say that these are just the Trojan horse that's going to lay the groundwork for an American invasion. So I think it's extremely important that the democracy promotion we do is actually tied to real democracy promotion and not necessarily tied to regime change by force.
Great, thank you. So can we take a round from the upper deck? So the lady at the front just here, in the second or third row there, and I think somebody right at the back up there too. So in that order, please, three questions. Those of you on the lower deck, I guess you'll be able to hear but not see them.
Hello. I was wondering, if you watch parties across Europe, and especially here in England, there is actually great political disparity within a party. So you have it in the Labour Party, you have it within the Conservative Party, that you actually don't feel they stand for the same political line anymore. So when you look at that issue, that they are so disparate already, do you feel it's a democratic problem that we now have a prime minister that we didn't elect? Because it's almost... For me, it feels that she represents such a different line, whether you consider that an issue.
Thank you. Lady there.
That's an interesting point, because I'm from Australia and we change every year at the moment, and I haven't elected the last couple of prime ministers. Anyway, apologies. Thank you for a fascinating talk. You talked about the West providing incentives and carrots as one of the solutions to this problem. Mm. I'm interested to know how you'd counter claims that that could be used as a kind of cloak for ulterior purposes or Western imperialism.
Thank you very much. And right at the back there.
Hi there, Brian. Just a quick question. Do you think there are any dangers or limitations associated with, particularly for these failed states or repeated failed states, as defining democracy as this, you know, or thinking about democracy as this absolute goal and therefore as a dichotomous construct, you know, of free and fair elections, therefore democracy? And have you thought about that in your research in your book?
Good. Thank you very much.
Okay, so the first one, the question about the political disparity. I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, if it were up to me with the Brexit vote, what I would have approached this, the way I would have approached this is that the referendum was asked, it was answered. Brexit, in that sense, was the will of the people. But no one ever said what Brexit meant or how it should be implemented. So I think to have a more democratic system, there probably should have been a general election that involved a real selection, because for many people, Brexit meant very, very different things. And now it's sort of... been given this mantle of, you know, we want precisely this hard Brexit, but what you're speaking about more generally is the problem of representation, and I think it's a major concern in a democracy. Obviously, you have more representation than you would if you had an authoritarian system, right? That's the first point. And the second thing is that, you know, electoral systems are set up that have trade-offs. So in like a two-party system like the United States with majoritarian electoral systems, you tend to have two major parties, right? And they absorb any sort of third-party movements as much as they can, and they become these big tent parties. And so as a result, you have people who are, you know, diehard Trump people coalescing with, you know, big business people who couldn't have less in common in terms of their actual cultural orientation, et cetera. It's a real problem. But on the other hand, if you have too low of a threshold for representation in the parliament, you might have 50 parties, and then you end up having either coalitions with one very extreme veto player, right, which is also problematic, or you can't form a government. One of the things about democracy is extremely imperfect, right? And that's something that, like, I can't defend that. It's got real problems. My argument is not that democracy is the ideal. My argument is democracy is the best because there's no better alternative. And if somebody articulates one, I would be all ears, because I've asked this... I've done a lot of conversations about democracy, and I haven't come up with a convincing alternative that doesn't share some serious, serious pitfalls. The question about the carrot and how you avoid, you know, with this economic proposal, Western imperialism. I very briefly mentioned in the talk, I spell this out a little bit more in the book, but I think there needs to be an objective, independent body before this is set up and years in advance that determines what democracy means and what the clear benchmarks are. Right, because otherwise you just end up with, like, all of a sudden Saudi Arabia is in there because the countries involved in this bloc just vote for it, and you don't want that to happen. Like, you obviously need to have this be a real commitment to democracy. And one of the things that I also talk about in the book is about how this needs to be a gradual change, because pulling the plug, I mean, if you're a realist in foreign policy, pulling the plug on Saudi Arabia tomorrow would cause the Middle East to collapse probably. And it could be very dangerous for the West, too, because Saudi Arabia is, its people hate the West a lot more than its politicians. So democracy, in that sense, could be very bad for Western interests in the short term. But I still think that there is a way to create these clear benchmarks that end up not being imperialist and actually have objective rules. The other thing that's good about this system is the EU has basically no sticks itself to deal with countries like Hungary What's it going to do? Is it going to kick Hungary out of the European Union because it's rolling back democracy? Maybe, but that's a very extreme step. This would envision the idea that there's different tiers, right? And so like you could just very easily just say, we're downgrading you if you keep this up, and you're going to be in the preferential access rather than the full trade block. I don't think this idea is going to happen, but I think it's important to consider realistic ways that you can entice countries to want to chase democracy rather than the West just saying you should do it, right? And that relates to the third point, which is this idea of democracy as an absolute goal. One of the things I talk about in the book, too, is democracy needs to deliver. I mean, we talked about Singapore a second ago. If I had a choice, I would live in Singapore rather than Benin. And Benin is a democracy in West Africa, but it's a very poor one, and your life chances are not good. And Singapore, your life chances can be good. And so for democracy to work, we have to make sure that they deliver. And this means, for me, that's why it's particularly incumbent. That one of the things I talk about also in the book is how democracy promotion money is spent. You've got to go for the places that have a realistic chance of becoming a model. I mean, Tunisia is a perfect example. Like, it is under serious stress right now because unemployment is really rising, right? But it's the only model for democracy in the Middle East. And think about how powerful that is for other countries. And so for me, it's about prioritizing countries that have a realistic shot, making sure that those interventions are targeted, not interventions in a military sense, but the effort to support democracy is targeted and done with the best practice strategies that have proven results and don't focus on some of the things you do see a lot of, which is endless workshops about inclusion for different groups and these type of things. Because if democracy becomes this ideal that's not attached to real solutions, nobody's going to believe it. Nobody's going to want it. And that's the thing that I think, you know, is so striking to me with the curse of low expectations in Madagascar is the people are being told that what they have is democracy. How can we possibly imagine that they should fight for democracy, right? I mean, if you look at that system and you believe that's what democracy is, I would not want it. So I think it's extremely important not only that we make sure democracies produce results, but also that we don't call things democracy that are not democracy. And we do that way too often, where we just slap this label on it because it's easier to do and it's easier to disperse aid because you don't want to be seen as funding a bad regime. And when you do that, you cheapen the value of democracy and make sure that people do not want to aspire to it and they don't believe in it.
Okay, thanks. Let's have another round. So, gentleman over there, gentleman at the back, and lots of gentlemen this time, sorry, and the chap here in the middle. Those three, please, when the mics reach you.
You mentioned trade as a possibility of building bridges to places that are building their democracies. But in places that have been formally colonized, how do you rebuild that trust? I mean, Haiti spent 100 years repaying debt from freeing themselves from being enslaved. So how do you, A, rebuild that trust? And second, along with rebuilding that trust, how do you provide an even playing field so that when they do start working towards building their economies, this isn't simply a matter of these larger countries taking advantage of them and then imposing policies that affect them adversely?
Okay. We had the gentleman back there. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. In the back over here. So we use the expression democracy, and one of the things I ask when people are referring to democracy, because it comes in many different forms, is about the sort of democracy that they're actually sort of suggesting would be the way forward. Mm-hmm. I agree that authoritarianism is probably not the best way, but then just saying the only thing else is democracy sort of neglects the concept there are many forms of it. I'd like to know, given your research and your experience, what sort of form or structure of democracy and how much democracy is the sort of democracy that you're referring to when we say, yeah, that's a suitable standard. Because more democracy might just mean I have to go to the polls every day, which is not great, but obviously I want the appropriate amount of representation of my views. So if you could just maybe take a moment just to say, when you think about democracy in not an ideal form, but in a respectable form, an adequate form, what comes to mind for you? Maybe it's parliamentary, maybe it's not.
Okay, thanks. And the third one, Just in the chap in the blue sweater. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Klass, for a really interesting talk. So you seem to present the West as being part of the problem here and also clearly key to the solution to the way forward. I just wanted to ask, is that really the only way you see it. When I look at Syria today, for instance, I'm seeing a very important counterweight to the West that's probably blocking the way actually for democratic transition in that country. So do you think really that the West holds all the cards here, or do we need to consider other key sort of geopolitical players?
Great. Very good questions. Your question is extremely difficult to answer. This is something that is going to take a very long time, I think. There's a few things. One is that any sort of trade bloc that I would propose would be an opt-in system. So if the trust is really broken, there would be no coercion, right? I think that's really important, because I think that by issuing that control to the countries to choose whether they believe this will benefit them, that's one of the first steps, because obviously colonialism did not do that, right? The other thing is, I think that, you know, it is incumbent on, and in the self-interest, I think, of Western players to not just steal resources, but to try to make sure that they work for the local economies. This is one of the major points I make about the sort of time horizon, political science term, about how far into the future you're thinking. And I think a lot of resource extraction, et cetera, is thinking very short term, and they're not benefiting the local communities enough, and that's going to cause serious problems like you have in the Niger Delta with the community turning against the extraction of oil. And I also think that, you know, one of the reasons why this short-term horizon exists in democracies where they don't think about the long-term benefit of the people that they're involved with, especially in these former colonial powers, is precisely because democracy itself. This is one of the difficulties, is that Theresa May cares about what's going to happen not in 25 years, right, electorally. And this is one of the things I talk about in the book, is the shift from being condemning a very quick inversion of Western foreign policy with regard to Pakistan. In 1999, when Pervez Musharraf came to power, he was the pariah of the West. And then in 2001, when September 11th happened and the democratic electorates in the West said the number one goal of our government is now to track down Osama bin Laden, Musharraf was the darling of the West. He showed up on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and ate a Twinkie. Now, it's about as far a reversal as you can imagine. And so this is one of the challenges. How do statesmen and stateswomen actually pitch to their electorates long-term commitments to people so that it is in their self-interest? Because I think a lot of what's happening with democracy promotion now is that it falls by the wayside when geostrategic concerns come into play or economic gains are on the table. And ultimately, you end up with none of the above. We don't have a very stable world. The world's growing slowly, and you don't have a very the democracy is on the retreat. So for me, it's about having that long-term commitment, because ultimately, you know, even though I think it's the right thing to do, I also think it's in the West's interest to democratize places. I think that if you have more stable places that have an actual safety valve for different viewpoints, that in the long term is better for the West. The second question about the form of democracy is a very good one. I don't have there's no cookie-cutter answer to this. Different contexts require different types of democracy. And sometimes in post-conflict zones, for example, there's been some proposals that I think are very interesting to do things like ranked choice voting, which is not a system in a lot of Western countries, but this is an example where you might want to think about a different type of democracy. What I mean by this is that, say you've got two warring factions that hate each other, right? If you actually force them to rank like five options, then all of the political players are actually competing to reach across the aisle, right? They're not just sort of saying, here's my block, here's your block. There's also different ways that you can have parliamentary democracy, you can have presidential systems. They can all work. It depends on the context. But what you said, I think, is very appropriate. You said there can be too much democracy. I think that's true. And this is goes back to sort of the SARS point I made, where the authoritarianism has some strengths in crises. Democracies can be really weak in crises because they have to respond to electorates who might be frenzied about some event. Terrorism comes to mind, right? And they might overreact. And so sometimes you can have too much democracy, and that's why I generally support representative democracy rather than direct democracy. And I also think that you have to think very carefully about how you set up, to talk about the point up here with how Theresa May was selected, how you set up the sort of selectorate that chooses leaders. Because when you have a very small sliver of one party voting, that can be worse than the elites voting, right? Because you've got 2 or 3% of the party choosing the person who's going to lead that party, then you get a really, really disproportionate voice to people who are actually totally out of step with the mainstream of the party. So that might be too little democracy, even though it seems like all of a sudden you're implementing this reform where you have primary-style selection or actual voting for labor, like labor leadership or conservative leadership in Britain. I also think the question from David, that's a really good one, about the West being the only way forward. One of the chapters in the book is actually about exactly that, and it's about Russia and China. They're the two countries that are doing the most damage to democracy. I mean, I think the premise of this book was, let's look at how the West can do better, because there's actually a chance to change. But the real global players that are inhibiting democracy are Russia and China. China is doing it because it's presenting a model for authoritarian rule that is very seductive to leaders in places where the Chinese model will never work. But they say it can work, so they say we don't need democracy, right? This is happening in Thailand, and I believe that you will see Thailand gravitating significantly closer to China after today when the king died. And that this is a major geopolitical struggle, that China is trying to pull this country in towards its orbit, and the West is trying to pull it into its orbit. And as a result of this geopolitical struggle, democracy is falling by the wayside because geopolitics is trumping concerns about how the regime functions. Russia is much more active, right? Russia is actively trying to undermine democracies abroad. And you know, this is one of the major challenges you see in a place like Belarus, where that is a reason why they're putting up with this leader, because they know that they have a fair shot of trying to at least have him play the game between the two sides and sort of be half on the West side, half on Russia's side. But if they completely condemn him, he's just going straight to Putin, right? And that's one of the major challenges. And there's a variety of Russian funding. There's these thing called GONGOs, government-owned NGOs, and also zombie election monitors. It's a funny term, but basically there's a variety of Russian election monitors that are complete jokes. They don't actually monitor the election in any systematic way, but they muddle the waters because they have this sort of name that sounds very prestigious. And then when the reporters who don't know what these are say, well, half of the people who went to the Azerbaijan election, half of the observers said it was free and fair, half didn't. So therefore, it's a wash, right? But every Western observer is saying, no, like, we literally watched ballots being stuffed into ballot boxes, right? And so this idea of muddying the waters and this sort of technological and digital diplomacy that is undermining democracy is another chapter I talk about where Russia is very, very active in it.
Okay. Okay, yeah, it's okay to be assertive. So first one down there, is there anyone up there? Yeah, okay. So gentleman in the front row of the top deck and they're in the second row of the top deck. I can see all the other hands, but, you know, there's a distributional problem and I'm resolving it in a more or less random way. Apologies. But we have time for a couple more rounds, so just be patient. Okay, so we're starting here.
Yeah, so I've been impressed about your presentation when you showed that a lot of people of the opposition of the democracy, they have been put in jail or they got tortured or something like that. And I come from a country that is Italy, where basically we saw in the last 20 years that the justice system has been like a way to use in order to go against opposition. And that's quite worried this, because you should think that justice system is independent. But that's probably a way why sometimes the democracy is not put in place.
Okay. So gentleman on the front row of the top floor.
Thank you for your presentation. My question is kind of different in the sense that there are people in different countries which are not democracies right now. When they look at the world and look at the past 10 years, they see everywhere that the West has tried to influence democracy in or tried to have a democratic transition, it hasn't gone well in majority of the cases. And those people now say that, okay, we don't want actually democracy because we see that it's not working and it's making the society worse, in the sense there are civil wars, there are more people dead and stuff. So what do you do in countries where people living under dictators don't want democracies themselves because they think the transition would be violent?
Okay, thank you. And the third question just behind him. Yeah.
Thank you for including Madagascar in your talk. I find it painful that it's the fourth largest island in the world and it never gets a mention in the press. And I visited it in 2006 and I was amazed at how the Malagasy were able to survive. They were very resourceful with the limited resources that they have. And I was wondering, do you see anything possibly bright in its future?
Okay. Thank you very much. Brian.
Great. So the first question was about the justice system in Italy and how sometimes democratic rulers can use seemingly impartial institutions to break the back of the opposition. This is one of the points where I think it's really important to think about democracy as not just a series of elections. Right? That practice of using the judiciary to oppose people who have legitimate opposition to the regime is not democratic. Right? It's something where it's actually askew. It's not you cannot use institutions of the state in partisan ways if you're going to be a full-fledged democracy. Right? It's a serious problem. This is something that happens all over, though. You're absolutely right to highlight this, and it's one of the things that escapes a lot of the attention. I'm going to talk about Madagascar again, and I'll talk about your question in the same breath. But in 2006, actually, when you were there, this exact thing happened, where the institutions were used by the state to have a sort of partisan bent. The yogurt kingpin, who is a very interesting character, he decided to, rather than rig the election with ballot box stuffing, he simply stacked the court in a way that would disqualify one of his major opponents. And it was literally like this bizarre situation where they said, you can't come back to Madagascar. He was in exile in Mauritius and in France. And so what happened was they just toyed with the opposition figure, like the judiciary toyed with him, by having every time that his plane took off and got close to Malagasy airspace, the president unilaterally closed all the airports in the country, and the planes were turned around. Like, and these were like commercial planes, so it'd be super annoying if you were on the flight. But no, he did this like four different times. And then what happened was the presidential candidate who wanted to run as an opposition figure, as a result of being turned away, didn't meet the deadline for his application to run as a presidential candidate. And then the Western observers said, well, the law was upheld because the law says you have to be here in person to sign your documents, and he wasn't. So for them, it was a totally acceptable process, and the election was given a stamp of approval, right? So this is ways that you can have partisan bents and use legitimate institutions of the state to advance your own goals in a despotic way, and it's seriously problematic. So that's why I would say, the idea that when the election ends in November in the United States, we just end as citizens, that's what creates this problem, because it allows these sort of manipulations to exist unchecked. And that's where also the press has a really important role in Western democracies, in places like Italy, to expose that these things are happening, rather than having clickbait, all the time that's just trying to get you to look at a story about Kim Kardashian being robbed in Paris. So the other question about the majority of cases of Western intervention gone wrong, this is a very fair point. One of the arguments I make in the book is I think that when you look at a lot of these failures, they're precisely because we didn't have the appetite to actually stick to the principle, and we actually gravitated away from it very quickly as soon as another thing was at stake, and that's what often undermines these transitions. Because we're not really, a lot of times the West is not willing to deal with the consequences of democracy. So if a party comes to power in a country that we don't like, we're not willing to say, well, that's the choice of the people. And sometimes that can backfire really catastrophically. I have a chapter that talks about this, and in Palestine in 2006, they had elections between Hamas and Fatah, which Fatah was much more viewed as the pro-Western party. And the United States funneled money into Fatah's election coffers directly. They actually gave them millions of dollars. And it became public that this had happened, and it completely backfired because the people are not super pro-United States in several, in Gaza, for example. And as a result of this, it swung the election, which may have gone to Fatah, actually to Hamas, right? And so sometimes by trying to over-meddle, I think that we create more problems than we have, and I also think we need to accept democratic results even when they're not the ideals of the West. Certainly there can be diplomatic consequences to countries that gravitate in ways that we don't like, but I think directly meddling in elections is not in the purview of the West. In terms of whether there's any optimism for Madagascar, the short answer is no in the short term. I am very, very depressed every time I go there. I love going there. The people are fantastic, but it is one of the most depressing places I've ever been, because there is just, every time I go there, the politicians are the same. They're in different parties. They're talking about the same things. And I've been going there, I've been six times since 2012, and it's worse every time. The democracy has not expanded in any meaningful way. There's been no reform. And I'm worried because the mineral wealth that does exist in Madagascar is very likely to be mismanaged. And so it's the one sort of possible way out is that Madagascar may have some serious oil wealth and may also have more mineral wealth than is known, but until the structures get in place where this can be reinvested in the people, it could actually make the situation worse. Sorry for that real downer.
Okay, thanks very much. We have time, I think, for a few more questions if Brian is up for it.
Yeah.
So one question here. Gentleman just back there and the lady just here. And if you can't hang on for another 5 minutes, could you at least not walk in front of the people asking the questions, please? Okay. Sorry if there was anyone on the top deck. Is there anyone on the top deck who is anxious to ask a question? Okay. We'll have one up there too, and then we'll call it a day. Okay.
Sounds good.
So if we can make a mic reach this gentleman here. So I think it was you first, yeah? Do you have a mic? Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. I started with you. Yeah. Go ahead.
So to what extent do you think that money is influential in the US election campaigns? And do you think this contributes to the flaws within democracy?
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll pass it over. Okay. Go ahead.
About the role of the European Union in offering carrots to countries that could become a democracy instead of the regime they have now. Do you think that's realistic given the current situation of the EU, and not only in a weak economic position, also weakened politically by Brexit, by far-right parties gaining a lot of support, globalization, open markets being very unpopular at the moment? And how could this happen?
Okay.
I'm interested when you draw comparison between Singapore and a democratic African nation. In what sense that the modern Singapore is not considered democratic? Is there any list that we have to tick the check boxes to be considered as an ideal democracy? And not to appear as a Singapore apologist, but coming from Malaysia, we sometimes look at Singapore with envy, as evidenced by the somewhat massive migration. And secondly, I would like to ask whether the West should continue to spearhead the democratization of the world, or should it be left to peer pressure? In certain extent, ASEAN has claimed credit to the democratization of Myanmar.
Okay, thank you very much. So one final question up there.
My question is about transition and how to create a democracy in a former dictatorship, and where would you draw the line in integrating people who are involved in a dictatorship? Because, well, I'm thinking about Spain and how it became a democracy, but no one went on trial, no one was judged, and then other examples like Chile or other countries where people were trialed.
Excellent. Thanks very much for making those questions sharp and short. Brian.
Sure. Okay, so on the first question about the influence of money on politics in the United States, it's a huge problem, and it's particularly gotten worse since 2010 with the Supreme Court ruling called Citizens United, which has basically opened the floodgates to corporate contributions. It costs a lot of money to run the campaign. The one that I worked on was just a statewide campaign, and we spent $9 million. I was gainfully employed on this campaign for 22 months. And it's a serious problem because it does give... In some ways, I was fortunate because the guy self-funded, but again, that also gives problems to the actual competition. I think it's a problem in a few ways. One is that lobbyists obviously have access to a lot more money and end up influencing politics considerably. There's a Princeton study that's been talked about a lot that shows that the top 10% of views in the United States get represented a lot better than the bottom 90%, partly because of this. I also think, for people who are upset about the current candidates, one thing that doesn't get talked about a lot is with Hillary Clinton, she basically steamrolled a lot of the opposition early on 2 years ago because it was obvious to every Democratic aspiring candidate that there's going to be $1 billion behind her campaign, right? And what do you want to do? Do you want to get just absolutely demolished by Hillary Clinton and sort of wiped out for 2 years? And that's why you only have three candidates, right? Because Bernie Sanders, the Democratic establishment sort of thought, well, he's a fringe candidate, we'll let him run as a sort of token opposition. And then obviously it got out of their hands, but it was something where obviously the role of money in politics not only influences the quality of democracy after the election, but also the candidates that participate in it. The second point about the EU, I will clarify and say, so I was saying the EU as a model. I don't think the EU would actually create this. I was talking about generally a democratic bloc of nations that could involve some EU countries, could involve India, you know, as an aspiring democracy that's actually, you know, one of the non-Western democracies, and these other different countries not necessarily based in Europe. The European Union obviously is in a time of crisis, but I think that it is still doing a lot better than many of the other countries around the world, and that its trade model that it used to democratize Eastern and Central Europe is something that is possibly replicable. How would it actually happen? I don't think it will actually happen. I think this is something where the point I'm trying to make is that we have no carrots, and we need to find a way to incentivize trade. I don't think it's likely that, because the real reason this won't happen is because it would put a straitjacket on Western diplomacy, that they would have to behave based on an idea, right? That they would have to trade more with countries that were actually doing things the way they say they should be doing things. And the West is not willing to accept that, right? I mean, it's like trying to wean the United States off Saudi Arabia is going to be a difficult process, even though there's cracks showing. But it is something where I think we should consider these sort of out-of-the-box proposals. I think if it did happen, it would be very beneficial because it would create a built-in punishment and reward to countries that actually chase democracy rather than just the consternation of the West. The question about Singapore is a difficult one, and I will say off the bat that Singapore is not a place that I have done a lot of... I've never been there. It's not a place that's one of the ones that I know a ton about. But its human rights situation is obviously talked about considerably as one of its major failings in democracy. And the reports that come out are very troubling about human rights in Singapore, and this is one of the aspects of democratic texture that's not just about elections, right? In terms of ASEAN, I would say that they've played a very minor role in Myanmar. I think that the West and the sanctions probably did play a major role in Myanmar, as well as the promise of being reincorporated into sort of the international world. But it's very interesting within ASEAN because one of the countries I do work in, Thailand, and Myanmar couldn't be more different, right? They're both in ASEAN, but Thailand is moving backwards on democracy as fast as it possibly can, and Myanmar is moving forwards, and those gains are not certain, right? We've seen some improvements in Myanmar's political system, but like the Rohingya minority are not being treated very well, and to put it mildly, and this is something where I think that the democratic reforms, we don't want to basically proclaim victory before the transitions actually occurred. And the last question about the transitions and where do you draw the line in terms of integrating the old regime. So this is something where I think, you know, I'm proposing this idea to be thought-provoking about how we can actually incentivize leaders to lose power, but it doesn't take a genius to realize that there's a serious moral hazard here, that if we give too much of a free pass to people who've done terrible things, more people will do terrible things, right? And that's why I think that... the decision of how to calibrate that needs to be made democratically by you know, global players. But I can also imagine sort of like a three-tier system, right? A lot of the people, like Laurent Gbagbo, who's in The Hague, he's not probably the worst of the worst. And I think it's interesting because in his situation, he was the president of Cote d'Ivoire who they believe committed war crimes during the Civil War. And the allegations against the current president of Cote d'Ivoire, I think, are equally credible, right? But he won. So he's not in The Hague, he's in power. And so I think, you know, you have to think very carefully about if we set the bar too low for what constitutes an unpardonable offense for a leader, then what you also do is create an incentive for them to cling to power forever, right? Because if they know that we're going to be tossed in The Hague and indefinitely detained, well, now all the incentives are lined up to fight, right? Because that's what, if you stay in power, like the president of Sudan, who's got an International Criminal Court warrant for him, he's not going to go easily, right? Because he knows what's going to happen to him. So you have to have this calibration, this push and pull between unpardonable offenses that should be punished so you don't incentivize them versus putting the good of the nation and the democratic transition and holding your nose for some sort of mid-level offenses. And that's why I think that somebody like Raul Cedras in Haiti should have been given golden handcuffs instead of golden parachute because he actually was a very bad leader. And I don't think we should just give people a complete free pass. Thank you very much for attending. And maybe you can, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, Brian. If you can just hold on for a few seconds, I have a couple of things to say before I invite you to thank Brian for his talk. First thing is, what a great talk. This is really fantastic to listen to, and it's admirable that he's done fieldwork in so many different cases and brought together a range of different experiences to make general points. And that's, you know, what comparative politics is all about. So, you know, if you're not already signed up to our program, come along. On a more practical note, there is going to be a book sale just outside the theatre, and Brian has kindly offered to sign copies of books that you buy here on stage. So if you want a signed copy of this book, which looks like a great read, then you'll have the opportunity. So the last thing I have to say is thank you very much for attending, for asking really nice, concise, and interesting questions, and for patiently waiting to the end. And let's give a great round of applause for Brian.